The election of Donald Trump as president in November 2016 shocked many a seasoned political analyst. As the nominee for the grand old party, Trump seemed like an anomaly. A born and bred New Yorker, married three times with no notable religious affiliation, candidate Trump didn't in any way fit the mold of a traditional Republican nominee. But what he lacked in base political credentials, he more than made up for in cold political calculation. In their new book, The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics, authors Angie Maxwell and Todd Shields use data on national and regional opinions and voting behavior to create an historical account of the three phases of the Republican Party's Long Southern Strategy used to reach new voters and to secure electoral victories. Angie Maxwell is the director of the Diane Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society, associate professor of political science, and holder of the Diane Blair Endowed Professorship in Southern Studies at the University of Arkansas. And she is the co-author of The Long Southern Strategy. And she joins us on the roundtable this morning. Angie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What got you thinking about this Southern strategy in particular?
Primarily, I started doing some research on the politics of Southern white women and digging deep into, you know, the ratification battle over the Equal Rights Amendment, and then just started realizing how little research there was on Southern white women and trying to consider when they moved towards the Republican Party. And it was that kind of, you know, path, following that path, that made me see kind of this bigger arc of the Long Southern Strategy, because we haven't talked about that part as much as we have about the influence of, you know, the use of racially coded language and religion. And so that was the bridge, kind of, this fight over the Equal Rights Amendment.
Did this come out of the 2016 election and seeing what had happened and there really being some cap, if you will, of an end of a story as to where we were and where we've gone?
Honestly, I started the book way before the 2016 elections. Wrote the proposal for the book in 2014. So before there was even a Trump, you know, candidate running. I didn't know if I might be saying we've kind of gotten to the end of this Southern strategy, or if we would see it, you know, played at a much more overt level, which is what it turned out to be.
So let us begin with a definition. How do you define the Southern strategy?
Well, the short version, which is kind of I call it the short Southern strategy, like the story we all know and kind of accept, is after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is passed, the Republican Party, when Goldwater is nominated in 1964, decides that it wants to try to break up the solid South that had been Democrat for so long, like a new electoral map. This was a huge fight within the Republican Party, and a lot of people did not agree. But that's the way it went. Nixon perfects it by tweaking some of the, you know, language, and then the South turned red, right? That's kind of the story we tell. But in truth, you know, in 1976, Jimmy Carter takes the South right back to blue, right? And Republicans are really concerned and trying to decide, do we keep going on this electoral, you know, strategy, this map strategy, and try to double down in the South? Or was that a mistake? And that's when they start looking for other opportunities, other kind of cultural cleavages that they can play to in order to kind of remake those inroads in the South. Same thing happens when Bill Clinton runs, another Southern Democrat, right? He wins back five or six Southern states, and that also makes Republicans concerned. And so leadership then decides, well, we're going to add, you know, really religion to the mix at a whole different level. And so the Long Southern strategy has to be seen as all of the cultural cleavages that the GOP kind of played into. Racial angst and angst over changing gender roles and the politicization of evangelical kind of Christian white fundamentalism. We've got to see all three to understand how the South really flips from blue to red.
Let's take those on if you can. And
sure.
What I'd like to do, I mean, one is, of course, I think we understand the race component and how that changed the dynamics. In the book, though, you make a very good case for the fact that we really overlooked the power of anti-feminism in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
We really did. You know, part of it is because we don't really understand the culture of kind of Southern white womanhood. It's a antebellum, you know, pre-Civil War kind of, you know, stereotype, but it has it has legs today, and that is that Southern white women are fragile and need to be put on a pedestal and, you know, out of the public limelight and protected from, at that time, really, you know, threatening Black males. And that was created, that was manufactured as a stereotype to justify kind of white supremacy and even violence, right, towards African Americans. So it's this kind of faux chivalry to maintain this political dynamic and power structure. But that culture kind of stayed with us. And so the idea when Phyllis Schlafly, not a Southerner from St. Louis, starts her organization, Stop ERA, which stood for Stop Taking Our Privileges, she really, you know, pitched feminism as not a choice, but it was going to require women to put their children in government daycare. It was going to require women to work, to serve on the front lines, all of this. And that was very, you know, upsetting, threatening to a lot of Southern white women that were not raised in a world in which they anticipated that or expected that or thought or were prepared for that. And even white women who had to work for financial reasons aspired not to for most of that history. And so when it becomes like it's going to be some kind of mandate, these Southern white women, you know, organize and they work to kill ratification of the ERA in the Southern states, which they successfully do. And they attend a big anti-ERA rally in Houston in 1977 to the tune of 20,000 people. And their slogan is Family Values at the conference. And the Republican establishment really takes notice. Reagan's team, looking to win back, you know, these kind of gains that Carter had reestablished, this bond between Democrats and the South, you know, polls 40,000 American women, and they divide them into 64 categories, call them Nancy's and Betty's and Helen's, and they realize that, you know, traditional gender roles is supported by a whole lot of Southern white women, which is, you know, and Southern white men, but Southern white women too, and they, if they can play to that, it might help them. And so they dropped the Equal Rights Amendment from their platform after 40 years of having it in there in 1980.
Obviously, the term anti-feminism isn't going to work. So you move to something a bit more palatable, which is family values. But then mm-hmm. that morphs into the Christian right. And how does that become ultimately so powerful?
It's almost a perfect storm, honestly. At the same time that you have this kind of Equal Rights Amendment fight going on, in 1979, fundamentalists take over the Southern Baptist Convention. And I don't say take over lightly. They, a couple of folks, organize and plan to elect a fundamentalist as president of the SBC. They set up like a campaign quietly, and they do that, and then they have that president, Adrian Rogers, appoint fundamentalists to all of the committees. They actually have a committee on committees. And over a course of 10 years, they really flip the whole organization. They fire and defund their lobbying wing, an organization that had been advocates primarily in Washington for just religious, you know, liberty. They just would look to make sure people had the freedom to exercise their religion. And they start funding and double down on a group that will push for the establishment of the Christian religion within the public sector as much as possible. So they start, you know, using certain issues like abortion and gay marriage to get some of these, you know, evangelical kind of Christian fundamentalists to the poll. Well, that dovetails perfectly with a lot of the criticisms of feminism, right, which was over its stance on reproductive rights, and particularly in the late 70s, starts to embrace kind of, you know, lesbian rights too. And so it dovetails perfectly. The GOP reaches out to a lot of those evangelical leaders. They give them a prime seat at the table. And over time, I mean, they support Reagan, but then they're disappointed in Reagan, right? They think Reagan's kind of says what they want to hear, but doesn't do anything.
Right.
So they start running one of their own. and a Pat Robertson. They don't have enough support for that. And so they really start becoming kind of serious politicos, trading votes and negotiating like any other interest group would do. And when George W. Bush, who they see as, you know, one of them, runs, they put the gay marriage amendments on a lot of the ballots in the states that they need to win. And that really rolls people out to the polls and solidifies that relationship between the GOP and that organization.
So in talking about the voter, let's talk about the candidate for a moment, because if you're a Republican candidate at this point and you want to win, you really had no choice but to look at these dog whistles of race, religion, and anti-feminism.
Well, if you decide that your map is the South,
yes,
right, and you really have to win those southern states, you know, and this is the part to me that's just, you know, kind of sad and tragic, is there's a whole lot of ways to win Southern. I mean, Southern means a lot of things, right? There are some positive aspects of Southern identity, right? Sense of family, you know, taking care of, you know, the land, sense of community, you know, all of that. But they really pushed on the three kind of hardest aspects, worst aspects of that, because they saw a concentration of people who felt that way in a region that they were trying to win voters. Now, that's not to say that it doesn't pull people all over the country, because it does. It absolutely does. It's just the pockets of people are denser in the those states they were trying to win, so that now running to the far right gets you more votes in those Southern winner-take-all Republican primaries. And when they put them all on the same day, SEC primary, as we call it, it's a big, you know, win. It's a big piece of the pie. And all of that has, you know, it's not that those sentiments weren't already there. They were there and they played to them, but they also don't let them naturally kind of dissolve. You know, it perpetuates it. It pours gasoline on it, right? On those fires. And that is what's really hard, is because it just perpetuates a lot of those attitudes, particularly when it's politicized.
Angie Maxwell is the co-author of the new book, The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics. Let's look for a moment at the election of 2016. You have a dozen plus candidates on the Republican side. They're running for the nomination. There are many candidates in that field who would fit the bill in any other year. Why was it Donald Trump, a man who was a New Yorker, had no real religious affiliation, had been married three times, had said outrageous things, let us just say perhaps anti-Christian things, or not to be considered Christian, that becomes their rallying cry?
It's a great question. And this is what's also, really sad, is that each of these forks in the road, there were lots of members of the Republican Party saying, don't do this, don't go that way, right? It was not universal or unanimous. And there were candidates who wouldn't do it. Those candidates lost, like the John McCains and the Bob Doles. And so that reemphasizes, this is what you have to do. But when I was looking at the 2016 primaries, I remember talking to a reporter like right before the SEC primaries, who said, who do you think is going to win these southern states? And I'm like, Donald Trump. And they thought I was crazy. And I said, he's playing the three dog whistles. And we misunderstand, because we've misunderstood the southern strategy, or maybe seen a shorter version of it. We have these myths about how the electorate works. So these evangelical fundamentalist Christian voters, the vast majority of them, you know, now operate like any interest group would. They're looking for who will do what they want them to do, irregardless of their personal, you know, values. There's not a litmus test anymore. You know, they kind of got burned by that. They thought a Jimmy Carter might help them, a Democrat. They abandoned that, right? And so now they're looking for who will do what we're asking them to do. And if you'll play to that just enough, and then the things Trump's said about, you know, women, I mean, we have a partisan divide on Me Too. Why? Right? We have a partisan divide on how people define sexual harassment and assault. And some of that is because for so long we've kind of ignored the kind of anti-feminist spirit and this distrust of working women and distrust of that, of, you know, women with political ambition. that has been really played to as part of this long Southern strategy. So when I'm looking at those candidates, I'm saying, who's hitting those three? Now, Trump is not ideal in by any way, shape, or form on, you know, kind of that Christian authenticity. And if there had been someone who was also playing the other dog whistles, it might have broken a different way. And for hardcore believers, a lot of those folks, we call them kind of creedal Christians. So it's the theology is everything to them. They went in the South, they went for Cruz. You know, outside of the South, a lot of them went for Kasich. But at the same time, and I mean this, you know, his last name is Cruz, right? And so right. When too many leaders in a party, not all of them by any means, but when too many leaders of a party are really kind of, you know, pushing against some animosity towards, you know, Latino immigrants and people of color in this country and making whites feel threatened by that and using some of that rhetoric, then, you know, there's going to be a residual effect on people who, you know, voters who are not educated about it might perceive as being, you know, of that group. You know, it's definitely not going to be enough support for a Ben Carson or a Carly Fiorina for all of these same reasons. Mm. Now, if there had been one person, if they'd all galvanized behind one other candidate, it's absolutely possible mathematically and numerically to beat Trump. Trump only pulls about, you know, a little under 40% of the vote in the Southern primaries on average, but it's winner take all in their primaries. And so because of that, when everyone else is getting 8 points, 10%, something like that, that little under 40% will do it. Right. So it's a dense group of like-minded folks who are really being catered to, who vote on the same day in winner take all primaries.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that the big difference between now and 4 years ago is, and this is somewhat anecdotal, but it seems that those dog whistles of race, religion, anti-feminism aren't dog whistles anymore. We just say them out in the open. It's not coded in any way. It's out there.
You're absolutely right. And that is an anecdote. I mean, we've got, you know, research that shows that, you know, particularly on race, you know, on racism, like we used to measure something, I mean, 50 years ago called old-fashioned racism. And that was just, you'd ask people questions about stereotypes of African-Americans, and they would say, yes, I think they are untrustworthy or lazy, right? Then we saw people not willing to say that anymore. You know, maybe it was social desirability, political correctness, I don't know. And what we then started measuring was something called racial resentment. And that is not as overt. It's questions that get at, do you think it's time to move past race? Do you believe there's been structural racism, right? Or, I mean, it asks it in a lay kind of layperson's term that everyone can relate to. And we realized, okay, it still exists. It's just kind of changed shape. Well, after Obama's elected, we saw a surge of old-fashioned racism come back, right? So there is something in the fact that you had a two-term president who was African-American, and then you had a woman as the party nominee, major party nominee in 2016, that has, like, catalyzed, you know, the resurgence of the overt language. Because probably a lot of the threat rhetoric, the, like, you know, whites are losing or women are going to take over or whatever, was an abstraction in a lot of ways for some people until they start seeing at the very top of our government, you know, people that don't look like white men. And then all of a sudden that abstraction, you know, hits at a deeper place. And so we have seen that resurgence. You're absolutely right.
And not to beat this point to death, but it seems that in 2016, 2015, 2016, and right up, including the inauguration and soon after, there was a concern that that behavior by the president would be, and the candidate and then the president, the concern was that it would be normalized. It would become mm-hmm. normalized. Well, isn't mm-hmm. that exactly what we have seen? We have seen that become normalized and emboldening other people to go out and to say, outrageous things, and so that we are having a discussion about whether this is white nationalism or not. We're having a discussion of who is a racist, and by simply saying, I'm not a racist, that then dismisses the point.
You're absolutely right. We are having that conversation now because it has become normalized, and we've lost our sense of, you know, boundaries or like kind of social norms. There were people that said that Trump wanted to blow up the system, right? I mean, he did in ways that are really significant. This is a party, the GOP, who nominated a John McCain 10 years ago.
Right.
10 years ago. And a Mitt Romney, who, people agree or disagree, don't come anywhere close to ever saying things of this nature. Nor do I think they would. Or Bob Dole. It 10 years ago, that's it, right? So there is absolutely, you know, this normalization of it that is happening at this time.
So is that just a reflection of who we are and who we've always been? And what some of us see is really frightening. Or are we going to be able to bring back some boundaries that make that behavior, that rein in that behavior, and put it to a place where it is not as acceptable as it is in 2019?
I honestly think it depends. I think it's possible to rein it back in. I mean, what's happened over the last 40 years is that the people that hold these attitudes on these three things, they used to be pretty evenly divided between the two parties. And they were, you know, post-civil rights movement, they were in a minority in those two parties. Might be a strong minority, but they've sorted themselves over the last 40 years. They've sorted themselves. And so now they have the majority in the GOP. You know, when you look at people who express racial resentment and modern sexism, which is how we measure that resentment towards working women, and this kind of Christian nationalism, it accounts for 95% of Trump's white vote. 95%, right? And so there are still, of course, a lot, high number of Republicans who do not share those attitudes, but they do not have the majority of their party anymore. It's going to take some of those folks breaking off, speaking up. It's going to take the GOP losing a couple of election cycles to regroup and try to figure out, you know, where do we go from here? I mean, it's exactly like when the Democrats in the earlier half of the 20th century had to make decisions about throwing off kind of Southern segregationists. Democrats held on to them for a very long time until they finally started saying, you know, enough is enough. If we lose you, we lose you, right? That's kind of the main thing that would change it. And continuing to get more people registered. I mean, we still have a lot of people in this country who don't vote at all. And so I think that the people that are vigilantly organizing and trying to call this out, you know, in the end, you know, will be successful. But it took a long Southern strategy to do this. It's going to take a long strategy to undo it.
But this has then become, because you just said it, really, if I heard you correctly, because if you said the long Southern strategy, it was a long Southern strategy that brought us to this point, and it's a strategy. So we take Southern out of it because it isn't as Southern as it was, right? We're including Michigan,
totally.
We're including Ohio, we're including those states, Minnesota, we're including states that aren't Southern.
Correct. It's Southern only in the sense of that was where it started, to appeal to these folks, right? And the number of people who share that combination of attitudes is densest in the South, but it exists all over the country. That's why we see Confederate flags fly in Ohio and monuments in as far away as Montana, right? It's that spirit, right? It's that we are going to celebrate these kind of reactionary attitudes. I mean, there was a YouGov poll in 2015 at 84% of Republicans that say about, you know, Confederate monuments that they're symbols of heritage. You know, not of racial, you know, animus. 84% of Republicans, right? So this is, they nationalized this Southern thing. And so now it isn't just Southern in like terms of geography. It's, you know, the Republican Party really remade itself in that kind of Southern image. And that has appealed to people all over the country in different pockets. And it's that that we have to kind of understand and combat nationally.
Angie, thank you very much for sharing with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Angie Maxwell is the director of the Diane Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society, associate professor of political science, and holder of the Diane Blair Endowed Professorship in Southern Studies at the University of Arkansas. The new book is The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics. It is published by Oxford University Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.